11. For the weekend, more snow on Saturday with another 1 to 2 inches piling on. Saturday's high around 11. Then for Sunday, turning sharply colder with a high of just 2 above. The normal high for this time of year is 31. The record high for this date is 68. That mark set in 1999. Right now, 3 above, a wind chill of minus 10. I'm David Cole, WGTD News. The morning show is next. Support for the morning show comes from Carthage College, where students can conduct NASA research, produce an original play, or join an in-house marketing agency as early as their freshman year. More information is available at carthage.edu. And we welcome you to the Thursday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg.
On today's morning show, we tackle an incredibly important topic, that of poverty, and specifically poverty in the United States of America. It is with us, even if we choose not to see it or choose not to appreciate it and understand its seriousness and significance in the lives of the millions of Americans who live in poverty. I am very appreciative of a new book that has been written that takes quite a comprehensive look at this issue, titled Broke in America, Seeing, Understanding, and Ending U.S. Poverty. I'm pleased to be speaking with the two co-authors of this book. Colleen Shaddix is a journalist. She's worked in both print and radio, including National Public Radio. And we'll give her a chance to tell the story of why she left her work as a newspaper journalist. It was very much around this topic of poverty, about which she has cared deeply for many, many years. She is also a fiction writer and a playwright, and brings her considerable talents to bear on this book, as does Joanne Samuel Goldblum, CEO and founder of the National Diaper Bank Network, which has made a very, very significant difference in the lives of all kinds of people living in poverty. And she also founded the Alliance for Period Supplies, which also speaks to some of the tangible ways in which we can make a difference in the lives of those living with poverty. She's written extensively on the topic as well. And again, the two of them co-authors of this new book, Broke in America, Seeing, Understanding, and Ending U.S. Poverty, published by Ben Bella Books. Joanne Samuel Goldblum, Colleen Shaddix, we welcome both of you to the morning show.
Thank you. We're happy to be here.
Colleen Shaddix, I made kind of tantalizing reference to the fact that you had an unhappy experience while working for a certain newspaper, and it speaks to the topic we're going to talk about today. I wonder if you wouldn't mind relaying that story to our listeners.
Indeed, I did. So my objective as a journalist was always to shine a light in the dark places, to tell those stories that needed to be told about things that could use some sunlight so that they could be fixed. One day, my editor called me into his office and said, "You write too many stories about poor people. It's killing us in the suburbs." So I quit. And went to work in a soup kitchen. That showed him. Now, this was not a particularly fine journalistic establishment, let me say. But I will say that across the field, you really don't see enough coverage of poverty, especially considering that even before the pandemic, 40% of us couldn't meet our basic needs. And when you do see that coverage, it tends to be a little bit voyeuristic and not really gain at the root causes of what's going on, and often reinforces stereotypes rather than combats them. So when my friend Joanne wanted to write a book about poverty, I was all in.
Very good. And we're glad that you have collaborated in this way. Joanne Samuel Goldblum, maybe you can tell us more about the connection between the two of you and kind of the nature of the collaborations you've had and this particular book as well.
Sure. So Colleen and I met what is now a long time ago when I had first founded the New Haven Diaper Bank, which is now the Diaper Bank of Connecticut. And a friend of hers was volunteering with the organization, and we needed some help with some graphic design. And Colleen's husband is a graphic designer, and you know, they helped us, and they've never stopped. You know, so we have really collaborated extensively over the years, and I think one of the things that makes the two of us working together work so well is that, first off, we really agree about most of these things, you know, really almost all of these things. You know, we do see the same way out of the problems. But also, since I'm a social worker and Colleen's a journalist, we're really able to bring sort of different views to things. And they really do mesh incredibly well.
One of the interesting things about your book appearing now is the fact that it appears on bookshelves during the COVID-19 pandemic. And I want you to talk for a moment about the way in which the COVID-19 pandemic has really, in a sense, revealed poverty to the rest of us in a new way.
Yeah, I think revealed is a good word. It showed the fault lines that were already there in society. As I said, before the pandemic, 40% of us couldn't meet our basic needs. And Joanne can tell you better than I, as a person who runs a nonprofit, how great the need was before the pandemic, but how it's just snowballed since.
You know, I think there's absolutely that, but I think one of the things that the pandemic really showed us, particularly in relation to this book, is that America is so set on the idea of deserving and undeserving poor. So the response to the pandemic, there has been amazing generosity. You know, nonprofits that provide basic needs have seen a great increase in donations, not enough to meet the need, but a great increase. But a big part of what we're hearing is people saying, well, you know, people impacted by COVID, they didn't do anything wrong. They, you know, this just happened. And really, the one of the biggest premises of our book is the fact that that is the American view of poverty. We believe there are some people who work hard and therefore, you know, poverty is not their fault. And then people who don't work, and those people is what we hear about a lot. And so, you know, certainly COVID-19 has laid this bare in a way that really anybody can see.
In other words, we have serious misconceptions about who is poor in America and why. And Americans, for some reason, gravitate towards this idea that at least most of the people who are poor, in a sense, deserve to be poor, or are poor because of who they are and the choices they've made. And while to some extent that perhaps is true of some people who find themselves in poverty, you would argue that that is a grave disservice to the vast majority who live in poverty.
Right. I think that, you know, somebody recently said, you know, when you get, you know, getting to make good choices is a privilege. Mm-hmm. You know, for so many of us, the ability to, you know, one of the things we talk about, for example, is everyone says, well, education is the way out of poverty. You know, and to some degree, that's true. But look at what's going on right now with the conversation about forgiving student loans. So many people are saying, well, I scrimped and saved, you know, we shouldn't forgive other people's. So we say go to everybody should go to college, but then people are so encumbered by debt that they never can get out of it. And so while a college degree might be a stepping stone towards, you know, accumulating some wealth, if all of that accumulation has to go to repaying your student loans, you really never get a chance to get out of it.
Let's talk for a moment about the dimensions of the problem and also the face of it. Your book shares all kinds of statistics that are pretty disturbing, including the fact that we're talking about 40 million Americans living at or below the poverty line. One of the things that you try to shake us loose from are some of the assumptions we make about demographically who are the poor in America. And it flies in the face of a lot of the assumptions that we make. Give us some sense of when we're talking about whites versus Hispanics versus African Americans, about what we see in those living below the poverty line.
Sure. I mean, if you want to picture a typical American in poverty, you should picture a white child. Children are disproportionately in poverty. And though the narrative may be that poverty is something that happens to people of color, the largest racial group in poverty are whites. People of color are in poverty at disproportionate rates, just like women are in poverty at disproportionate rates because of racism and sexism. But we've really made poverty a non-white thing in America, which allows us to overlay all kinds of racist assumptions on people in poverty. And I think it's one of the big reasons why we don't take more action to end poverty in a country that clearly has the resources to do so.
One of the things you tell us is that poverty is something that many of us never see because of, I think what at one point in your book you call economic segregation. Mm-hmm. Tell us more about how that is true. I think that is, I don't argue with that at all, but I think that is something that most of us have little, if any, awareness of, that fact that we, in fact, are so neatly and tidily sequestered from the poorest people in our society. How, in what ways is that true? Does that sequesterment occur?
So, you know, the biggest way that it really occurs is by the fact that we tend as communities to see people who are like us. Now, one of the biggest reasons that we chose to write this book focusing on the entire country and focusing on many, many different people is because we are so able to convince ourselves that poverty only exists in, say, Appalachia or in an inner city, you know, someplace else. And we really wanted to say, no, it's happening in your town. You know, but because the media sort of portrays, you know, homelessness as somebody living outside with a shopping cart, a single adult. You know, the fact is that, you know, you're homeless if you're couch surfing. You're homeless if you're living in your car. But you don't know if the person serving your coffee in the morning is living in their car or is living at someone else's house. There's no way to see that. You know, we like to think that if somebody is in poverty, that you could tell, you know, they'll really be, that they'll stand out in some way. And then that's just not the case.
At one point in your book, I read the words, poverty is quite ordinary in the U.S. And there's something incredibly shocking and disconcerting about those really sort of matter-of-fact words. Poverty is quite ordinary in the U.S. Something else that you write in your book that I think is important for us to explore is when you say that poverty is growing and spreading. Mm. I wonder if you could clarify what you are saying there, because I think a lot of us hear that poverty is growing. We don't necessarily hear that it is spreading. Help us understand the distinction between those two terms, growing and spreading.
I mean, it kind of goes back to what Joanne said about all sorts of different communities. There was a time when inner city was a shorthand for a poor community of people of color, right? But the inner cities are becoming quite gentrified. So you will find more and more people in poverty in these outer ring suburbs of cities, which creates all sorts of problems. Transportation systems really weren't built to accommodate that. It's harder to get where the jobs are. There aren't social services out there. One of the things that surprised me that we learned was that automobile ownership is going up among low-income people. And that's because there's no other way to get to a job but to drive there because of the demographic changes that we just haven't adjusted to at all.
For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with Colleen Shaddix and Joanne Samuel Goldblum about their new book, Broke in America, Seeing, Understanding, and Ending U.S. Poverty. It is a comprehensive look at who is poor in the United States and the reasons why. And also, it paints a picture of a road out of this current situation in which we find ourselves. Take us back to, I believe, the year is 1963, which is when some kind of work was published that led to what essentially is the methodology by which we calculate the poverty line and those who are living below that poverty line as the poor, and explain why, in your view, that is a sadly outmoded and ill-equipped way for us to be looking at this problem now in 2021.
Sure. So, you know, the federal poverty level relies heavily on the cost of food, which hasn't seen the inflation that housing and healthcare have. So the federal poverty level for a family of three is just over $21,000. A family could earn considerably more than that and still not have the money they need just for material basic necessities. So the number is really meaningless. The self-sufficiency standard is something different that many groups and organizations are starting to use. And it calculates what it actually costs to live a frugal life. And it varies by community, right? Because of course, what you need to live in rural Alabama is different than what you need to live in Los Angeles or New York City. And so that's really the issue, is just that the federal poverty level, instead of addressing poverty as an issue, we're trying to sort of define it out of existence. But the definition doesn't change the fact that people can't meet their basic needs.
So in other words, the idea of creating an abstract numerical line and below this you're poor and above this you're not. I mean, there's just something kind of ridiculous about that, particularly when the whole point should be about how people are living or unable to live. And that kind of numerical designation, especially when it's indiscriminately applied across the board, whether in the heart of Detroit or in rural Arkansas or wherever, it doesn't serve us at all in understanding this issue.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. Absolutely. And not that there couldn't be a number. I mean, the self-sufficiency standard, you know, comes up with numbers, but it does it based on true costs and true costs in different areas. It even goes so far as to go county by county or city by city, recognizing that, you know, living in Detroit and living in Milwaukee are two different things, and the costs there would be different.
One of the things that I most appreciated about your book, and which I found really illuminating, very helpful, is the first part of the book, right after the first chapter, which kind of talks about the dimensions of the problem and in words, helps us throw off out the caricature of who is poor. Then you explore in a section called Basic Needs, various aspects of people's lives. And for those of us living with some level of affluence, we never stop to think about how essential all of these elements are to a worthwhile and happy life. Water, food, housing, power, transportation, hygiene, health. Tell us why you thought it was really important to discuss the problem of poverty within this seven-tier framework.
I think you should answer that, Joanne. Your basic needs.
Okay. You know, basically all of the work that I have done over the last 17 years has been focused on basic needs. And the reason for that is, as a social worker, I used to do what's called community-based social work. So I went to people's homes and helped with various things. But what I saw over and over again was this level of poverty that, even as somebody who thought that they understood poverty in the United States, I couldn't believe what I was seeing. You know, in my own city, in New Haven, Connecticut, I'd drive a mile from my home and I'd be at someone's house who didn't have heat and hot water. And, you know, my obsession with basic needs really started with a woman that I was working with, a mom who was developmentally disabled and had three young children, and they never had toilet paper. And, you know, as a clinician, I was working at Yale Child Study Center, we thought very clinically, you know, we tried to understand why she didn't have toilet paper. And the fact is, she didn't have it because she didn't have any money. And the what underlies all of this is that there is no clinical intervention for not having toilet paper. So when we send social workers, nurses out into the field and say, you know, we want you to work with this family on parenting, I mean, I can try to support somebody to become a better parent, but if their baby is sitting in a dirty diaper and they don't have a clean diaper, no amount of education is going to change that. And so sometimes we just have to stop and give people what they need. And that's why we focused on these areas, because, as you said, so many of us who have enough money, or even struggle a little bit, but sort of can manage, don't realize what it can mean, you know, the difference between having a clean diaper for your baby and not, you know, because what it can mean is that you can't go to work that day because you need to bring a supply of clean diapers to your child's daycare program. By and large, there are some that don't, but most do. And so that can mean you can't go to work one day. And again, we're generally talking about people who are working hourly. So if they don't go to work, they don't get paid. And it's this whole snowball that something as small as a diaper can, doesn't always, but can really make the difference between keeping a job, and keeping a job can be the difference between keeping a home. You know, so it's just this cascade of issues.
Right. One of the things you say is that while we at least make some kind of concerted effort to make sure that people are not hungry, that we supply them with food one way or another, not enough help, but some help, I think it's a concern many people understand. Most of us do not stop to think that you can't use food stamps or whatever the assistance might be to buy toothbrushes and toothpaste and deodorant and so on. Those are the kind of things that are completely out of the reach of somebody living in the depths of poverty. And what you're saying is you've seen that up close and the effects that that has on people and their lives.
Yeah, and I always have to say, and you know, after I say this, Colleen might want to speak a little bit. I always feel like it's important to be genuine. I personally have never experienced poverty, but I have been really, lucky to have people be willing to share their experiences with me.
Yeah, people were so brave and honest. Mm-hmm. I'm so grateful to everybody we talked to for the book. People really opened up about what is considered a shameful experience in this country. One man I spoke with, he was living in his truck at the time, and he kept telling me during our conversation, I'm a good person. I really am. I'm really a good person. Didn't say anything that would make me believe otherwise. Why do you need to stress that? Well, he needed to stress that because it is shameful in America to be in poverty. And that's why people inviting us into their homes and their workplaces was really such a gift.
One of the lines in your book that haunts me, really remains with me, and I think for anybody who reads the book and or listens to this interview, I hope they will really take this into their hearts, is when you write, poverty makes it harder to stay healthy, clean, punctual, well-fed, a litany of things that help you to earn a living. We just don't stop to think about the heavy burden that poverty is when it comes to these essential matters of life. Colleen Shaddix, as a journalist, I want you to say something about a moment in the book when you and your co-author take journalists to task for not serving this issue as well as they might, as we might. At one point, your book says, even journalism can be a poor source of information about poverty. In what way have even serious and well-meaning journalists not done what they need to be doing in terms of helping all of us understand this issue and situation better?
You know, when people have done academic studies reviewing news coverage, and when you read or see a story about people in poverty, those people are overwhelmingly African American. That's just not true. That's not what poverty is in the United States. And I think it feeds into those stereotypes we've talked about, where people can really impose their racist stereotypes on anyone in poverty. There is also a tendency to do the hero story. Look at, she was homeless and then she graduated from Harvard. And that's wonderful. And that person should be celebrated. But you have to always point out how exceptional that person is. That person is not a model for change. You know, that's like winning the lottery or being a gold medal Olympian. It's just not in everybody's wheelhouse. We very much make poverty particular about a person or a place. And we certainly found this when we were writing the book. A lot of publishers said, okay, good idea. Focus on one family. Now, no one would ever write a book about being middle class in America and say, okay, we're going to focus on this one family. They live outside Cincinnati. They have 3.2 kids. Like, but we feel that we can typify the experience of poverty, and we can't. That's why Joanne and I took so much darn time and went so many places, because the only thing that all poor people have in common is that they don't have money.
It's so interesting because at a glance, it would seem to be the most humane thing to talk about people and to talk about poverty as a people issue that affects human beings. So let's take a close look at some of these human beings and their lives and what they're experiencing and so on, which in a sense is one dimension of your book. Mm-hmm. But really, it seems to me that the heart and soul of your book is that this is not a problem with these people. I mean, these people are suffering from this problem, but in so many instances, they are not the cause of the problem. Bad policy is the cause of the problem. So really, the most humane and effective way to be talking about poverty is to be talking about policy more than people. And that's a connection that a lot of people, including me, tend to miss.
And certainly to link those personal stories to policy. We write a lot about water access in the book. Right. Talk with one woman who grew up in Navajo country where 30% of people don't have water. Her family did not have running water. Once a week, the kids shared a bathtub of water, and afterwards that water was used to wash all the family's clothes. There was not a school on the reservation. They had a long bus ride to a school where kids had very different experiences, and she got teased all the time for having BO. So she dropped out. You know, that's a very personal story, but that's not just about Darlene's family situation or the cruelty she experienced at school. 30% of homes on Navajo reservations don't have water. That's outrageous.
And that's a policy problem that ultimately causes suffering in the lives of people. But in a sense, we find it easier, if sometimes difficult, to talk about people and their problems versus the policy that sets all of this in motion.
Yes.
For those of you just joining us, we're speaking with Colleen Chaddix and Joanne Samuel Goldblum about the book they have co-written called Broke in America, Seeing, Understanding, and Ending U.S. Poverty. As I said, your book, its main framework explores some of these areas of basic needs: water, food, housing, power, transportation, hygiene, health, and the ways in which being poor impacts those essential facets of life. And then in a section called Forms of Oppression, you explore things like racism and sexism and denial of access to voting, mental health discrimination, and so on, disparities in education that also contribute to this fact. I want to be sure, however, for us to take some time to talk about the third chapter of the book, or the third section of the book, which takes up solutions. At one point you write, this book combines heartbreak and hope, the twin streams always at the source of advocacy. Joanne Samuel Goldblum, tell us about the way in which you and your co-author have paired heartbreak and hope, I suppose not only in this book, but in your lives and in the work that you do.
So I think that one of the issues in trying to work to alleviate poverty is that it can feel incredibly heavy and overwhelming. And I think that we as a society like to feel good. You know, we like to ignore the difficult things. And so I think that it's heartbreaking to think that there are people, your neighbors, who don't have running water. That is heartbreaking. It is hopeful because we can change it. And that's really what we wanted to say to people is, it is within our power to end material deprivation in the United States. It is. It is a matter of will. Now, you know, it's also heartbreaking that we don't have the will. But, you know, so it's sort of, we believe, and I think honestly, I think it's safe to say that Colleen and I would not be able to get out of bed in the morning if we didn't think that we could change this eventually, because we can. But in the meantime, you know, to think of the child who's going to school dirty, to think of the person who loses their job because their child has asthma and they're consistently being called out of work, or because they don't have a home, that, you know, we wrote about a family in Baltimore, I think, who had a child who had asthma, and they were living with other people. There wasn't space for the child to crawl. And even when he could crawl, there was animal dander. And the child's asthma was so overwhelming that he couldn't recover, and the mom lost her job. You know, that's heartbreaking that our medical system isn't generally able to prescribe housing, isn't generally able to prescribe those social determinants of health that we know are so important.
One of the things I really appreciated about the book and the way you explore this topic, and how you go beyond spelling out the dimensions and seriousness of the problem in important detail, is then you take us, even as you're talking about the problem, you offer us glimmers of hope, which you explore more extensively at the end of the book. One of the ways you do that is these places in the book when we see the words "a better way," and you are showing the readers, in a sense, success stories, isolated though they may be, that sort of point to how much better we can do with certain aspects. I wonder if maybe each of you could choose one or two of your favorite moments in the book in which you talk about a better way, examples in which efforts to help people living in poverty have been effective and point the way to something better.
Go ahead, Colleen.
Okay, well, I'll start with one that is particularly relevant right now, baby bonds, because Representative Cori Bush and I can't remember the co-sponsor have introduced a bill that would establish exactly that. There is a tremendous racial wealth disparity in this country, tremendous. And wealth is as important as wages. There's times it's more important than wages, because wealth helps you get over that rough patch when you're sick, when you've lost a job. Wealth helps you take a step up to start a business, to send a child to college. We've had structures in place that have made it difficult for African Americans to acquire wealth at the same rate whites have, and those structures still exist. We know that when communities or nonprofits put aside a small amount for a child at birth and let that increase over time, parents will really make considerable sacrifices to contribute to that fund as well. And when the child is 18, he or she will have a little bit of a nest egg to use for education or to use for getting established out in the world. It's a small investment that is really life-changing. And I'm so glad to see that it may be getting beyond the small demonstration project stage.
Very good. Your co-author, Joanne?
Yeah, I would say that you know, and I'm actually looking for it because I want to be sure that I can talk about it exactly right. We talk about water, and in our water chapter, we talk the better way in our water chapter is about a city, Lansing, Michigan, I believe,
yes,
that has introduced a way to do two different things. One is they proactively addressed the issue of lead. So, you know, the reason it was so interesting is because we know about cities where that hasn't happened. And they went and upgraded all of their pipes, you know, so that the water would be safe. And so it's so simple when you look at the way that they did it. They had a will. The will was to make sure that children in Lansing weren't being poisoned by the water they drank. And so, you know, to me, that was such an uplifting story because it wasn't just, as Colleen mentioned before, a single feel-good story. It wasn't me saying, my neighbor doesn't have water and I'm going to give them money for it. It was a city saying, our budget shows what our priorities are, and this is our priority.
By the way, I don't want us to run out of time without giving you a brief moment to talk about the National Diaper Bank Network, which you are the CEO and founder, which I think is responsible for doing a lot of really good work, as is your Alliance for Period Supplies. Just say a quick word about what that organization does.
Sure, thanks so much for that. You know, basically the National Diaper Bank Network and the Alliance for Period Supplies works with local diaper banks and basic need banks to get product to people who need them. So what I think is exciting and a little bit different about the work we do is that we both get people product and we work to change legislation and policy. So we're made up of about 220 or a little bit more member programs who are all independent organizations that work in their own communities, getting diapers and period supplies out to their community. You know, and they all raise money and, you know, all of that. We're able to be a collective voice and a collective body for all of that work. You know, and the reason we do it is for all of the reasons that we wrote about in this book. People need diapers. Women, menstruators need period supplies. You know, and no amount of talking about it is going to change it.
Right.
So
it reminds me of what you say about the old adage, you give a man a fish, you feed him for a day. If you teach him how to fish, he'll feed himself for a lifetime, or however the phrase is made. And basically what you're giving us is an example of how sometimes you need to give a man a fish and sometimes you need to give a young mother diapers. You don't need to talk about it or put something on a blackboard to educate them on something. They need that and they need it now. And without it, their lives are impacted in really terrible ways.
That's exactly right. And I mean, I think that really is what we hope people take away from this book.
Colleen Shaddix, briefly tell us why towards the end of the book, you and your co-author, in a section called How to Change the World in 8 Steps, take apart the whole matter of advocacy, something that we sometimes think of in rather simplistic terms, just like we tend to think of poverty in simplistic terms. Why is it important for us to have a more nuanced idea of the work of the advocate and advocacy?
I think in recent times, there has been a confusion of posting on Facebook with advocacy. Certainly, talking about things is a great first step. We want people to talk about poverty. We want people to talk about diaper need. We want to get these issues on the front burner. But sooner or later, you have to work with other people. That's where you multiply your power, and that's where you make change. And it's not rocket science. You know, if you ever ran a bake sale, you can do it. You just need to sort of make a plan and take some steps. And we've tried to lay those out in a really concrete way that makes it doable for everybody, whatever your particular gifts are, whatever your particular connections are, you can be an advocate.
Well, it's exciting to think about all kinds of people who care about this issue, perhaps understanding it much better and also much better understanding what needs to be done in order to change this unhappy situation. And I, for one, came away from your book with not only a deeper understanding of poverty, but also a deeper understanding of the possibility that we can rise above this this shameful situation. And I really hope that many, many people are going to seek out your book and be inspired by it as I was. The book again is titled Broke in America, Seeing, Understanding, and Ending U.S. Poverty, published by Ben Bella Books. The co-authors, Joanne Samuel Goldblum and Colleen Shaddix. Thank you so much for the very good work that you, of course, have done even beyond the writing of this book on this important topic of poverty. And thank you so much for being part of the Morning Show today. I was honored to speak with you.
Thank you so much.
It was wonderful.
Tomorrow on the Morning Show, it's the birthday of our 16th president, Abraham Lincoln. And in honor of that, we're going to be replaying excerpts from three of my favorite Morning Show interviews over the years related to our 16th president, his life and legacy, including Ronald C. White, who has written the definitive biography of Lincoln, as well as Philip B. Kunhart III, who is part of a distinguished family of American historians who have over the course of generations, followed and preserved much Lincoln memorabilia. On Monday, I hope that you will be able to hear my conversation with Rob Rapley, director, writer, and producer of an amazing documentary film that will air Monday night on the PBS series American Experience called Voice of Freedom. It examines that memorable occasion on Easter Sunday in 1939 when Marian Anderson sang a recital on the steps of the Lincoln Memorial. It examines not only that dramatic moment, but also puts it in context of what made it so tremendously significant and inspiring. That is Monday's Morning Show here on WGTD. And we remind you that you can subscribe to the Morning Show podcast through Spotify, through Apple Podcasts, through Google Podcasts. It allows you to enjoy a different Morning Show 7 days a week, and in many cases, such as Monday, to hear extra material that is not part of the broadcast. Be sure to search for The Morning Show with Greg Berg. Support for The Morning Show comes from Carthage College, where students can conduct NASA research, produce an original play, or join an in-house marketing agency as early as their freshman year. More information is available at carthage.edu. We're approaching 9 o'clock.